since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America. They fought to end slavery. They joined with allies to win two world wars. They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord. Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces. The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide at 1041thetruth.com. To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Good afternoon, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're here on a beautiful Tucson sunny day for another episode of American Warrior. Sometimes I start the show with anniversaries, military history. And we're pretty close to an anniversary here right now. On March 19th, 2003, following an airstrike on the presidential palace in Baghdad, the coalition forces moved into Iraq. This was the beginning of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and while major combat operations were concluded by May 1st, quite a bit of combat and casualties will continue for many years. Today, we're very, very proud to have a guest here on American Warrior, a gentleman, an American warrior himself, who was in the thick of things during the peak of the worst 12 months for U.S. forces from July 4th, 2006 through July 4th, 2007. He's recounted those experiences in his new book, Chief, My Journey Through Iraq at the Peak of War. Welcome to Chief Master Sergeant Scott Dierdorf, United States Air Force retired. Welcome to American Warrior, Scott.
Thank you, Ben. Good afternoon, everybody in Tucson.
So good to have you back, Scott, and I hope that you'll be able to stick with us. I understand you just had some surgery done.
Yeah, nothing major, you know, just taking care of myself in my older days.
Older days. Well, that sounds kind of funny. Scott, I've met you. You are a bear of a man, and you're kind of like the chief master sergeant out of Central Casting. And I tell you, I just got done reading your book, and folks, I really encourage you to pick up a copy of this book. We'll have the website. You can get it on Amazon. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But, Scott, the thing that struck me about this book was it was like peeking into and sort of sneaking a peek at someone's personal diary, which makes it even more compelling. And I got to tell you, and I told you this off the air, it was somewhat of a difficult read for me because I know a lot of the persons in the book. Obviously, you and I are acquainted. I consider General Rand a personal friend of mine. I've had the opportunity to meet Ginger, Major Gilbert's widow, and several other folks. So tell me, start us off with the book, just sort of a brief description about what motivated you to record these thoughts and to publish these words for people to see and to read.
Well, thanks, Ben. You mentioned the anniversary of the start of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and so the story of this book actually goes back to the beginning of that. I was in Baghdad in 2003, a little bit later after the initial invasion took place, and we were under attack every night. Our unit was there. At the time, I was assigned to security forces, and we were assigned to protect the Baghdad International Airport. And so just one night in the middle of all that, our unit first sergeant came to me and we just started talking about my previous deployments and combat and what was going on there. And he knew that I was some bit of a storyteller. And so he said, you know, one day you need to write a book. And so I shrugged it off and said, okay, sure, first sergeant, whatever you say. And then we just went on about the night's business. And then a couple of days later, same conversation. And so when he finally pressed the issue three or four more times with me, I looked at him and I said, okay, First Sergeant, someday I will write a book about our experiences in Iraq. And at the time, I probably intended on that being about the 2003 time frame. And then go forward to 2006, as you mentioned, I got there in July. And just the incredible impact on my life that 1 year combat deployment had changed my entire focus of what I needed to do. And actually it was General Rand that furthered the desire to write a book because he told everybody when we were there that we need to go back and tell the story. At the time, people weren't, and I still think people aren't telling the Air Force story about what we've done in combat. So that was really the genesis of why I decided to write the book. why I wrote it the way I did, I think it just fell into place. And I had about 4 months of time to start when I first retired before I went back to work. And during those 4 months, it was kind of a almost part of my healing process to let it be known how I felt and what I went through as an individual and as a leader in that combat situation.
You know, Scott, it's interesting when you say that. It makes me think, I believe that film today sort of acts as the window to our society. And what you just said there reminded me of a scene from We Were Soldiers when towards the end of the movie, the colonel tells Joseph Galloway, with the reporter, who says, "Look, sir, I don't know how to tell this story." And the colonel says, "You have to, Joe. You have to, you know, tell the people what my men went through here today." And that, this book, I got to tell you, Chief, is very powerful. Now, it's not your first book. We had you on Daily Mail, I want to say about a year ago, where we did an interview about your first book. It was called A Cup of My Coffee, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. This is a whole different, this book has a whole different feel to it, I guess, is one way to put it.
Yeah, like you said earlier, Ben, this is more of a personal accounting, and so some people who know me, like you, would not get the impression of me that I'm somebody who has emotion or that frequently or often shares that. But, you know, what I wanted to do is just tell a whole true inside story. There's a lot of books out there right now about individual operations, you know, operations where a mission, an operation was, you know, undertaken and we captured someone or, you know, those type of things. There's a lot of books like that. What I didn't see or hadn't seen out there was someone sharing almost journalistic-like, daily accounting of life. And so the fact that you said it felt like you had a peek inside, that's kind of what I was going for, is I wanted to allow the reader to kind of walk that short mile with us. And, in fact, one of my early previewers said that every mom, dad, brother, sister, uncle, and aunt of anybody that served in Iraq should want to read this book, because it'll tell them, it'll show them what it's like. And most of the warriors, myself included, have a real hard time, just sitting down at the dinner table and telling those stories.
Well, and I would really second that emotion. And folks, I'd encourage you can get it on Amazon.com. The title of the book is Chief, My Journey Through Iraq at the Peak of the War. Scott, we're coming up on our first break here, but when we come back, I'd like you, one of the common themes, and of course is close to me because I consider General Rand a close personal friend, but one of the common themes throughout the book is your relationship with General Rand and how both of your leadership qualities, I guess, really came out over that time in combat there in Iraq. Before we go to the break, though, just tell our listeners, I thought one of the most touching things at the entry of the book was what you told Kim Ram before you left, what you told the general's wife as you two were deploying to Iraq.
Well, it was a very personal moment, and that's one of those that when I put it in the book, I wasn't sure if I even wanted to add it, but, you know, she knew that I had been to combat before, and while he was a very experienced warrior, he had not been to Iraq before, and she, of course, like any spouse, was worried. And she told me, you know, that I needed to take care of him and bring him home. And that was a very poignant moment in my life. Someone who, you know, I'm used to having responsibility for young folks, young airmen and young soldiers. And now I had someone who I knew very well actually asked me to kind of take that responsibility to make sure that her husband came home. And I promised her that I would do that.
And you did. You were as good as your word. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around. We have got a very, very compelling interview, some stories. We're interviewing a storyteller today. Our phone lines are open, 751-1041, if you'd like to interact with Scott, Chief Dirda. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
And we're back here on American Warrior. Folks, if you have a question, we're live. Give us a call, 751-1041. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined today by, like so many of our guests, a true American Warrior, retired Chief Master Sergeant Scott Dirda, 27 total decorations, Legion of Merit, 3 Bronze Stars. the Afghanistan and Iraq campaign medals, and the Air Force Combat Action Medal. Scott, if I'm not mistaken, you were the first chief to receive that medal?
I'm not sure if I was the first chief. I was the first command chief serving in that capacity to receive it, but there may have been a chief in the special operations world that received it. I'm not 100% on that.
Well, and I'm just trying to lighten things up here because we're going to get in some pretty intense conversation, but as I recall from your book, when you were awarded that medal by General Rand, it was so new that there was actually no real medal, so he kind of gave you just a little made-up medal to put in your pocket.
Yeah, that's true. Someone had cut out a picture of it and and laminated it and pinned it on me that way.
Now, just to frame the discussion here, Chief, have you given any thought to – I find it interesting that your assignment there began and ended on the 4th of July. Has that – ever crossed your mind the parallels to Independence Day?
Yeah, it did, and it was something that General North, the absent commander, commander of Air Forces Central, he had aligned it that way because he felt like there was some kind of, there was definitely historical significance to us being there and doing that, starting and ending the new leadership role on Independence Day and how we were trying to create, independence for the Iraqi citizens. So we definitely did that. In fact, I had a standing record. I was the only person besides General North that was on Balad Air Base July 4th of 2006, 7, 8, and 9. So 4 years running, I was there at that change of command ceremony. It was a very special day for me.
You know, something else I found really interesting, given my status or my love of military history, you were assigned to the 332nd Air Expeditionary Wing. And tell us why that, if folks who follow history and Air Force history in particular, folks might find that interesting.
Yeah, very special to me as well. The 332nd Fighter Group, which was activated in 1941, became known as the famed Tuskegee Airmen. And, of course, they had an absolutely impeccable record in combat all through World War II. And the colors of the 332nd were actually encased sometime after World War II, and then we reactivated them in 1998 in Kuwait, which ended up becoming the lead wing for all of our combat operations in Iraq. So we became known as the modern-day Tuskegee Airmen, and we actually carried that legacy forward. We brought we had the historians actually shipped over some of the Tuskegee legacy pictures and things that we actually hung up in our building. So we're very proud of that legacy and proud to be called a Tuskegee Airman myself.
Well, and Scott, I think the interesting thing that I find about that as I'm reading through the book is, of course, anyone familiar with the Tuskegee Airmen recognize they were called the Red Tails because they had their aircraft, the tails of their aircraft were painted bright red to be very distinctive. And, anybody I think who initially meets you like I said, you're a bear of a man, you're the chief from Central Casting, would think you're a tough guy. You are a tough guy. But what struck me about this book is really, as you mentioned, the examination about your feelings and your actions of losing airmen in combat. And I'll tell you, I mentioned the Red Tails because I want to start with the phrase you probably would be happy to never hear again, all Red Tails report to the command post. I see that phrase reported over, repeated over and over and again in your book.
Yeah, it actually brings chills to my body just hearing you say it. When I say it myself, it's a little different, but when I hear somebody else say it, it almost brings me back to that moment. It was anybody that's been in a difficult situation like that, and when you hear radio communications, the tone of voice of the person is always easy to interpret. And when it's something like that, there was just a seriousness about their tone. There was just something about it. You just knew that was a bad news call. And so we heard that more often, of course, than we wanted to during our year. And it always, seemed to be that we had taken another casualty.
And 13, if I'm not mistaken, during your 12-month period there.
That's
and
correct.
When you start off the book, you made note of every single one of those airmen that you lost during your time there. 13 total. The first being Airman Le Bernard Chavez, who was a defender. And I say that because I got to tell you, when you talk about, hey, you need to tell this story. The folks need to hear it. There was, and I want to expound on that, but I just want to read something because I really found this to be, as a civilian, just so, so powerful. When you were after Airman Chavez was and I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah, that's correct.
After he was killed in action, You and Colonel Larry Jackson were kind of going out and checking on the airmen, his fellow defenders. And there's a segment in your book where you point out that there's a one particularly distraught airman who looked up at the colonel and said, "What now? What do we do next?" And I want to read you his quote of what he said. You know what it was, but I want to hear the listeners to hear this. And Larry Jackson, Colonel Jackson responded, "I'll tell you what now. Tonight we honor Airman Chavez by remembering his service and mourning his sacrifice and keeping in mind the family that he leaves behind and the ultimate sacrifice that he made. What's next is tomorrow we mount back up, go out to patrol those same streets where Airman Chavez was killed today. If it's important enough for him to give his life for today, it's important enough for you and me to go out there and try again tomorrow." Tell us about Airman Chavez, Scott.
Well, you know, the young man himself was very young, but a leader, kind of the informal leader among his team, a team of 13 security force defenders who were tasked to go in downtown Baghdad each and every day and conduct training with Iraqi police, because the Iraqi police, you know, force had been decimated and they were all starting new, so they really didn't have any training. So Chavis and his squad was one of several that would go into the town each day, set up around the police force, and some of the non-commissioned officers would go in and conduct training on how to run a police department, how to do basic policing skills. And, you know, Chavis was that guy that could be counted on by everybody, and his team would always look to him. He was the first one up to do details in the morning. And what he did at the beginning of the training was he volunteered to be the gunner in the turret for his particular squad, and that was the toughest duty at the time. In fact, many of the early casualties in Operation Iraqi Freedom were turret gunners of all the services, because it was just a vulnerable position to be in. So it took extra courage in order to take on that duty. A lot of times it would be delegated to someone, but in this case, Chavis was the one that just stood up and took that, and he was adamant about it. He didn't want to take a day off and let someone else take his place, for fear that someone else would get hurt where he's supposed to be out there. And so he's just a young man full of character and was absolutely loved by all of his teammates. And so when he was killed, it was obviously a very tough day. And Colonel Jackson's statement is what I consider one of the most courageous leadership moments that I'd ever witnessed, right beside the one with Major Gilbert. Is that, you know, if he had told that airman that night, "Well, you know what, we're not sure if we had, you know, the right equipment or the right tactics. Maybe we didn't train you guys properly, and therefore we're going to stand down the mission and not go back." Well, that whole squad, in fact, that entire unit would have just lost confidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we've been going out for months at a time. We've been going out here doing this every day, and now you're telling us that maybe we didn't have something right, and they would have just lost confidence. So those guys did mount up and go back out on the streets, and they completed their mission. I think about 45 days later, they completed it. And, you know, really, really tough. But the character of Chavis, you know, I think had a lot to do with it. It was reflected in their team leader in the letter that I shared in the book.
And, Scott, I'd like you to, when we come back after the break, talk about Lieutenant Colonel Walker's comments in the context of Major Gilbert. But before we do that, one of the things when I read about you, and I pulled up a little press release about your retirement, and one thing that impresses me about you is you were the command chief, but you seemed to, contrary to what some of your leaders might have wanted, you just had a way of, you spent a lot of time outside the wire. You wanted to be out there with your airmen, making sure that things were taken care of. Is that, I can't imagine that was an unusual philosophy, but I see that coming up over and over again in the book, and I'm sure your men and women appreciated that.
They do, and I've been critiqued by some of my peers for being that way, and it's just that was the style that I chose to do and to be with them. If we expect them to go out and take something on and do it, then we ought to be willing to do it ourselves. And so I wanted to be next to them. Now, I wasn't out there, you know, every day like they were, certainly, but I tried to be on the front line as much as possible with our guys when especially when things were going bad.
So they call that leading from the front rather than the rear, I think.
Absolutely.
I tell you, we could use a little bit more about that in our country. Now, folks, again, Scott, this book is available on Amazon. When was it published? Just recently, correct?
Yeah, it was published in January, and it's been out for a couple of months now, and there are some reviews posted on Amazon, so if any of the listeners want to go and check it out, there's some reviews on there from people who I don't know, and they've had very similar comments to you that, they were pleased with how much the emotion and how much, inside look the book provides.
Now, Scott, are you insinuating that I might be biased because you and I have actually shared a toast?
No, not at all. In fact, I think, as an author, you're going to get feedback and reviews from people you know and those you don't know. Sometimes the people who you know won't be as honest with you if they had something negative, but I have plenty of people who are offering me all kinds of thoughts, and so I rest assured that you would tell me exactly how you feel.
Well, I love the book, and folks, I encourage you to buy the book, read the book, give us a call if you'd like, 751-1041. We've got Chief Deard up here for about another half hour. Chief, when I come back, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about Major Gilbert and another real tough part of the book for probably both of us. We'll be right back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia on American Warrior.
Blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
And we're back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Chief Master Sergeant Scott Deirda. He is the author of a new book called Chief, My Journey Through Iraq at the Peak of War. And Scott, welcome back. We were talking just before the break about the first airman you lost. And now I'd like to, if it's okay with you, just talk about November 27th, when that call came over the squawk box again, all red tails report to the camp command post. This was a very, more so, I guess, I don't know, it's hard to gauge, but also a very touching time for you. Tell us about Trojan.
Yeah, all 13, obviously, losses were tragic and hit us emotionally. Some of the people we knew a little bit more, so, there's a little bit more of a personal connection. And with Major Trojan Gilbert, he had been stationed at Luke Air Force Base here in Phoenix, in Glendale, with General Rand and myself. So we had already been working with him for a couple of years. We knew him. We knew his family. We had spent time with them at different events and holiday parties and then just the daily working with him. And so when Major Gilbert joined us at Balad, he brought the normal level of enthusiasm and energy that he brought to everything he did, a wonderful human being that just, brightened up the room when he walked in. And he came there and filled a special position for us, but at the same time he was working on our staff. He was also flying with one of the, F-16 combat units. And so over the first 2 months, Trojan and I had many encounters, one of which was on the 20th of November, where he and I, the general, and about 15 of us went out west to Al Asad. We were trying to set up a new airfield out there to bring in a unit of A-10s, which is very familiar to many of your listeners. And so we went out and spent the day, and at the end of the day, we were getting ready to go. We were waiting on the crew for our Army Sherpa transport, and Major Gilbert had the idea that we should all get some photos together. And I'm not much of a photo guy. I don't necessarily like my photo being taken, but we agreed as a group. We all went out, and after we got our group photo, then Major Gilbert said, "Hey, Chief, come on, let's get a picture of me and you. We don't have any pictures of me and you." And we didn't, actually. There was not a single picture of him and I anywhere. And so we stood there. I made him pick up a rifle because as a pilot, he normally only carried a handgun, so gave him a rifle so that he looked like a tough guy in the photo. And that is certainly my favorite photo of all time now, of Major Gilbert and I standing there. So we had that connection. And at the end of the day, he told me, that he wanted to go out and do some missions outside the wire with me so that he could get to spend more time with our guys on the ground. And I promised him that I would try and do that. And then go forward to the 25th, I actually encountered him in the dining facility, and we had a brief encounter there where I tell people that if I'd had 2 hours to plan what I was going to say to Major Gilbert, I couldn't have got it better than what I did. And what happened, what the exchange that happened between us that night in the dining facility was just spur of the moment. He said some things, I said some things, and it ended up being the last time I would see him before he was killed in his crash, you know, not 2 days later.
Now, Scott, I think it's interesting, again, as a civilian, and for some of the civilians listening, we talked earlier in the interview about leading from the front and how you had a tendency to go out. I was outside the wire. I was surprised. I mean, General Rand was also leading from the front. He was flying sorties himself in an F-16 into combat, and that played a particular that gave you sort of a fright when you first got the news that you'd lost a pilot.
Yeah, it was a whole series of events because when the call came over the radio, I was actually returning from a meeting that I had every day with senior enlisted members around the base, and it seemed like it took forever because the traffic was just, you know, I knew there was something bad and I had to get back there. And I also remembered when I left our living quarters, our village, the Red Tail Village, that morning that the general's vehicle wasn't there, which was a little unusual unless he was flying. So I had it in my mind that the general was probably flying. And I got to the building and saw that his truck was not in front of the building, and I thought, okay, so the general's not here. That means he definitely is probably flying. And walked in and spoke to the vice wing commander who, you know, when I looked at him, I knew just the pain on his face that something was seriously wrong, that we had probably lost somebody, and it was very, very personal. And at the time, Major Gilbert never even entered my picture because I just hadn't put it together. I was thinking, for those moments, I was thinking it was the general had been, you know, shot down in combat. And so Colonel Renfro, the vice wing commander, finally was able to tell me that it was Trojan, which for about a millisecond was relief that it wasn't the general, and then all of a sudden it turned to the fact that this was my friend, Major Troy Gilbert, who had been lost. And my first question to him was there any chance, like, you know, had mm-hmm. he survived the crash?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he confirmed right away that that was not possible.
And, again, folks, I encourage you to read the book because, you know, Scott is a bear of a man, but it's very clear from your words on the page, Scott, just the way, I mean, you had to grab a wall. Because that was a very tough time when you got that news.
Yeah, I fell back against the door. I remember that specifically. And it took several minutes to kind of get my composure and realize that, you know, we needed to go find the general who was, in fact, getting ready to fly. In fact, was in the cockpit and at the end of the runway when they called over the radio and told him that he needed to return and shut down his mission. And he brought his F-16 back into the squadron. They unloaded him, and he went in and got the news. And then Colonel Renfro and I met up with him briefly after. And I would tell you, you know, this was one of those, the next 24 hours was just amazing the way people acted, reacted, and handled their business. I was continually amazed at how we fought through such a difficult time.
And which leads me to my next, the other thing I want to remark about, a leadership comment. Major Gilbert's plane went in, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, it crashed. And so there was a real morale issue with the maintainers. And tell us a little bit about how Lieutenant Colonel Walker addressed that. Again, another just a wonderful quote that I was so impressed with, leading from the front.
Yeah, just a couple hours after the news came to us, we had begun our notification process in the command post, as we always did, and then the ops group commander decided that he was going to go down and visit the squadron, and he asked the general and I to go with him. And so we all responded down there, and we met with Lieutenant Colonel Walker, who was from Cannon Air Force Base, squadron commander. And, you know, of course, the general asked him how they were doing, and he said that, you know, that they were holding up just fine. Everyone else was accounted for. They'd spoken to everyone, and that they were ready to continue flying. Because normally you would think that there would be, you know, some bit of a stand down and people would want some time off after that. And normally, you know, after an aircraft accident, you know, the maintenance teams take it very hard. They you know, there's obviously going to be, you know, questions, you know, did the plane go down because of a maintenance issue? Did they not do something right? And so there's a natural, you know, a drop in morale. And so what we witnessed there was Colonel Walker said that, you know, he told the general they were ready to fly, but he said, before I do that, I need to go speak to the maintainers. He had gathered them all over in front of one of the hangars, and so we went with him. And a short walk later, we get over to the hangar, and here stood about 300, you know, maintenance airmen all the way, you know, from you know, the youngest airmen through their captains and the chiefs. And you could just see the mood, you know, everybody was downtrodden, their, you know, their shoulders were slumped and, you know, they're looking at the ground and they're, you know, obviously concerned, did I do something wrong or, you know, was it my fault? And so this was a tough moment. And Colonel Walker went around the corner and basically said, you know, all eyes on me. And he got their attention and still not everybody looked up. And he said it again, all eyes on me. And then he, over the next minute, he told them that, you know, I have full confidence in you guys. What happened today was a terrible tragedy. We lost a plane. We lost an airman. But I know that it was, you know, not your fault. It was nothing that you did or didn't do. And so I have complete confidence in you, and I need you to pick up your shoulders, you know, pick up your chins and get back out there, because I told the general that we're going to continue to fly missions. And you could just see the, like, the air came back into people's lungs and the shoulders went back, and, and they decided that, wow, our commander has confidence in us, even though we've had this tragedy. And I tell you what, those people picked it up, and I don't know, I certainly didn't pay them enough for what they did and how hard they worked to recover and go forward from there.
Well, you know, it really strikes me. He didn't just speak the words. I mean, he actually stepped up and said, I will fly the first sortie. He showed them, he paid them the compliment and showed them that much confidence in the work, saying, look, I will personally get in one of your jets and fly.
Yeah, he did say that, and that was probably the Highlander moment of the of the entire scene.
Hey, folks, as you can probably tell from the background, Chief Dierdorf is not in studio with us, but he is available if you'd like to call and ask him a question or make a comment, 751-1041. We'll be right back, and that's the timing of that barking is perfect, Chief, because not all the stories were sad. Next, when we come back, I want you to share with our listeners a little bit about Finding Nero, one of the next chapters in your book.
All right.
This is your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. We'll be right back.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. If you want to support them, start with WoundedWarriorProject.org. Now, back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
And we lit up your world.
And we're back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. Last segment of American Warrior, we're joined by Chief Scott Dierdorf, United States Air Force retired, talking about his journey through Iraq at the peak of the war. If you're enjoying this, listen, check in with us on Facebook, American Warrior Daily Mail on Facebook. You can download a podcast of this interview and past interviews at 1041thetruth.com. Also, share that information with your friends. Scott, coming back, this, as I mentioned, we've talked over the course of the whole interview. This is I don't want to say painful. It's a tough read. It's a very honest read, and I've enjoyed it very much. But it's not all about sad stories. And I tell you what, I really, really enjoyed your chapter, Finding Nero. And tell us about what was so special about Nero and the occasion there.
Yeah, it was pretty nice of my own pup to get her plug in there to get the Nero story.
Good intro, huh?
Amazing. Yeah, they're amazing how they work together. So military working dogs do a wonderful job in combat. And as you can imagine, their handlers become very close to them, and they, in most cases, they actually live together because there isn't a traditional kennel like you would have at Davis-Monthan or any other base. And so oftentimes at the forward operating base, the military working dog handler and the dog itself would share the same quarters, so these guys are together 24/7, so the bond actually gets even stronger than it normally is. And unfortunately, on one occasion, a young handler had left his dog in his quarters and had gone to the dining facility to get something to eat. And while he was en route, a mortar round came in, and he was injured by that incoming round to the point that he was medically evacuated by helicopter and brought to Balad from his forward operating base. So somewhere in the mix of that, he was separated from his canine partner. Well, we were off base at another forward operating base, and we had returned, and the general notified me that we had an airman that was injured in combat and then was over at the hospital. We needed to go check on him, and so we did. And as we got there, we went in and we met this young staff sergeant, and we spent time with him, got to know him. And then as we finished up and we were leaving, the colonel that was with us looked at the general and said, "Did you see when you guys brought it up and you talked about his dog?" Because I had asked the question, where was his dog? And he basically said he didn't know. You could see that there, and I missed it actually, the colonel saw that there was another level of pain. Here this guy is injured, he's got some pretty bad leg wounds, but there was an increased level of pain when he had to admit that he didn't know where his dog was. And he said that, they had gotten separated back at the FOB. So we made some quick calls and found out that his dog had actually been transported to Balad and was in the kennel there. And so I looked at the general and I said, "Well, let's go get him." And it's pretty unusual because dogs are not welcome in the hospital just because there's some sanitary rules within the medical world. And the general said, "Well, I thought we weren't supposed to do that." And I said, "Well, this was one of those occasions where we're going to do it." So we actually drove to the kennels, walked in and told the kennel master, I said, "Hey, I'm here to pick up Nero." And he said, "Well, I already know what you want to do. You want to take him to the hospital and meet up with his handler, but you can't do it at the hospital." And I looked at the E6, and I said, "Well, I'm here to take the dog, so you can either come with me or I'll take the dog myself."
This was clearly the first time he'd met you, Chief.
It was the first time we had met, and I really wasn't that dog friendly at the time, but I was determined I was going to take that dog and act like I knew what I was doing and get in there. So we loaded the dog up with the kennel master and drove back. And then ironically, as we get back to the hospital, the base comes under attack, and we had several mortar rounds that landed right within 500 meters of our position, probably closer. And so we all took cover, and instead of taking cover and running to or crawling to a concrete bunker that was nearby, I told the general, I said, "Let's just go inside," because they had concrete walls surrounding the hospital, which provided the bunker coverage. And so here was the general, the colonel, myself, the kennel master, and this wonderful 100-pound shepherd. We're low crawling across the parking lot, get our way into the hospital casualty evacuation area where the handler was. And as we came in, he was in a back room with all the other wounded warriors at the time, but something told him he needed to come out. And so he came crawling out between the doors as we came crawling in, and I said, where is the handler? And they pointed over in the corner, and we got up and walked that dog over. And I'll tell you, when the dog and the handler came together, I don't know if you can actually see tears in a dog's eyes, but It was a moment that I'll never forget, that those two being reunited was the most joyous thing probably the whole year that I saw.
I mean, just to paint the picture in people's minds, I mean, here's the handler. I mean, he's all bandaged up. This guy's wounded. And he's there embracing his dogs sitting there on the floor of the hospital.
Yep. And everybody else was like, right around, the general told us all to move back and give him some space, and we did. And so once we got the all clear, a few minutes later, everybody started getting up, moving around, and the handler actually walked over to me and grabbed me in a big battle hug and told me that, he would never forget what I did. And, it seemed like such a simple thing. This dog and the handler should be reunited, but I guess, he had been told that he didn't know where it was, didn't even really know, if his partner Nero had survived the attack. So pretty highly emotional moment.
Well, I tell you, Scott, I had a point of personal privilege here. That's why that story made me smile, because having had the honor of knowing General Rand and being in a meeting where the general made a and I use the quotation fingers, a suggestion, which in my world is just that. It's a suggestion. And then I rapidly discover that, no, when the general makes a suggestion, you make it happen. And good on you. I can almost see the twinkle in his eye when he told you, hey, Chief, we can probably do something about that, can't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the other, I see you refer throughout the course of your book, you pay a lot of, give a lot of credit to the hospital and the medics, and you seem to spend a lot of time there with the hospitals. Anything you'd like to share and just sort of augment on your thoughts about our medical personnel in the combat zone and just some of the miracles, literally, that they performed?
Yeah, the whole year was full of miracles, and then I had the chance to go back a couple years after that and see it as well. And you just can't say enough about what the medical teams, and these were joint medical teams, so all the services contributed. The majority of the people we had at the base hospital there were airmen, but there were all the services were represented, and they worked together so well. I watched them bring people back to life. I looked into a surgical room one night where they were doing three separate operations on the same person at the same time, and one of those was brain surgery, and it's just amazing things that they did. 19-year-old kids that were climbing up on top of gurneys and doing tracheotomies, stuff that they would never be allowed to do, in a normal environment, but because it was combat, they were doing it. And the amount of procedures that were developed by our doctors over there that had now been implemented back home in trauma centers, the list goes on and on and on. So I actually got more from being at the hospital for myself than I ever did for them, and they knew that. I was there getting kind of therapy for myself and hanging out with the medics and talking to the wounded. Really was kind of a way that I winded down at the end of each day.
Now, Scott, we've got about 3 minutes left. I want to say, folks, I encourage you, go out and get a copy of his book, Chief, My Journey Through Iraq at the Peak of the War. You can get that on Amazon.com, probably at your local bookstore. Scott, one other thing I'd like to cover real quick, because I think it's important as I deal with people out at the base and kind of around the community. We're having more and more warriors come back, and the wounds, if you will, are not always that visible. It struck me as I was reading a portion of your book when you were back home on R&R and your son, I think, shot you with a Nerf gun, and your instinctive reaction for just a brief second there. And can you kind of put that in the context of what maybe some of our warriors are dealing with and how we need to continue to provide support and understanding?
Yeah, well, certainly everybody has had a different, experience, but those who've had experiences similar to mine, many are far worse. What people just need to understand is that when we come back from a traumatic situation like that, we are different. And the sooner we realize that we're different, the better we can, work our way back into society. And the sooner that society realizes we're different and just understands that, don't treat us different, but be aware that, there are certain things that are going to cause a greater reaction. I think there's so much help out there right now, so many great programs. It's up to the warriors themselves now to get themselves involved, and if they do, I'll tell you, I've had, in my civilian capacity now, I've had the opportunity to hire 9 veterans myself.
Wow.
Some of them have had very similar combat experiences to mine, and they deal with it, and some are going through counseling, but they're fantastic in the workforce. They do great, and they've integrated back into society, but maybe myself having that experience helps. But I would say I would encourage anybody, give them a chance and just get to know them and understand that they've had some different life experiences, but they're still fantastic people and they're going to be dedicated and loyal beyond what you can imagine.
Now, Scott, don't be shy. You got a lot of ears out there now. Tell us, what's the website for your consulting service?
The website, it's pretty easy. It's like writing a letter. Dear Duff, that's dearduffconsulting.net. That's my website. And if you're looking for an autographed copy, you can contact me there, and I'll get that mailed out to you. If you want to get it from Amazon, they're available. Both my books are available on Amazon. You can look me up as an author or look up Chief, My Journey to Iraq at the Peak of War.
Folks, buy this book. Scott, thank you for your service to our nation, and thanks for writing this book. Very, very powerful stuff.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate what you guys do down there in Tucson, a great area, and I look forward to getting back down there.
This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, another wonderful American Warrior program. Hey, listen, we're going to change things up a little bit. Stay tuned for Daily Mail. We're going to get much, much sweeter. We have the folks from Cakes for Causes in the studio. Stick around, folks.